Farron Doggs is the founder and CEO at Harrison Wallace Financial Group, a regular guest on the Wintrust Business Lunch. And wow, Farron, we got to talk about the markets today. My friend Steve Alexander pointed out just a minute ago that when we flirted with 40,000 on the Dow a couple weeks ago, well, here we are now, 2,000 points lower. What's going on?
Hey, John, thanks so much for having me again. And yeah, it's been quite a week. It's not unexpected in terms of giving a little back. We had such a big run the first quarter of this year. And having some of that inflationary data on top of it certainly kind of added fuel to the fire. And so all of these expectations that the Fed was going to cut rates has continually been pushed back and pushed back. And we're seeing a lot of money come out of the market right now, and people are taking some of that profit that they saw the last quarter of last year and the beginning of this year. But I think we have to keep our eyes on the ball a little bit and say, you know, the S&P and the NASDAQ are still up around 7% year to date. I mean, if you annualize that, you're looking at over 20% for the year, and that would be incredible. So we kind of knew that the steam was going to have to run out of this a little bit. And I think the data just gave us a reason to do it.
The data being that inflation number?
Oh, yes. Yeah, I'm sorry. Yeah, really all the data that came out this week was pointing towards, you know, higher inflation, that it's not calming down. Some of the key areas of inflation are really hitting the consumer, primarily in the food and shelter areas. And insurance, you know, that's kind of come to a head this week, especially about auto insurance and just how expensive that has become over the last couple of years in the increases. So that hits everybody. You know, everybody eats, everyone has to have a place to live. so it is hitting the consumer, and it doesn't seem to slow down. So it means higher rates for longer.
Sure. Higher rates, yeah. Mm-hmm. I think everybody's kind of been playing this, how many rate cuts are we going to get this year? How are you scoring that right now?
Well, I was always in the camp of two, maybe three in June and July, you know, combined. But I don't know. I'd be surprised if we get one at this point. You know, if we don't start seeing this data change, and I know I mentioned last time we spoke, you know, the Fed did the heavy lifting over the last 2 years, and I don't think they're going to be inclined to unwind that anytime soon, because, you know, it was painful while they were doing it, right? But they knew it had to be done, and I don't think they're going to be too anxious to undo it too quickly.
Was there some inevitability to what's been happening in the last, I don't know, 5, 7, 8, 10 days? That is, the market, as you said, had a nice run up, and there was inevitably going to be a swing the other way. Is that also what's happening?
I think so. You know, after October came out, the CPI in October, we saw the market just really take off, because in 2023, it was most of the gains were in the last 2 months of the year. And, you know, there was just all this expectation. I remember people talking about potentially 6 to 8 rate cuts in 2024. And I thought that was a little aggressive for the reasons I just stated. Yeah. And, you know, these things, you know, there's so much momentum going into that sort of thing. And everyone has FOMO because they don't want to miss out on these returns, even though a CD is paying pretty decent returns for stable value. And, you know, it's bound to happen. And again, I think the data that we saw come out just added fuel to the fire and a reason to kind of rebalance and take some profits.
Jamie Dimon is pretty bearish these days. At least that's the way I'm reading this. I know you saw some of his comments, Farron. What do you say about that?
Yeah, I did. And I can't say I argue with him. He's obviously got his pulse on the financial world pretty closely, and he sees all these credit markets and how, you know, private financing is kind of impacting some of the conventional financing. And, you know, I know he mentioned potentially 8% interest rates. I certainly hope we don't see that, but it could be a factor if the Federal Reserve, in fact, turns and says, we just got to get this inflation under control So we're going to actually have to raise rates versus cutting rates. And I've heard more and more discussion about that over this last week than not. And, it's a reasonable thing to think, but I also have to look back and say the consumer is slowing down. The consumer is more focused on buying necessities these days than they are, you know, extras and discretionaries. And I think that that will continue to slow down as the inflation pinches the pocketbook. And that by nature will usually slow down the amount of money coming into an economy. So, but I don't disagree that I think we are in for longer rates or higher rates for a longer period of time. I do think I heard a statistic the other day and said once inflation gets over 5%, it takes almost 10 years to get it back to 2. And, you know, they're talking about trying to get it back to 2 in 4 years, you know. So I think the reality is we are in for higher inflation for a longer period of time. I think the unemployment market, I think some of these job reports are a little bit slanted and misunderstood because you're seeing people having to take 2 and 3 jobs, and some of those jobs are counting as new jobs that are created. And we are seeing most of the jobs in the healthcare and government side of the coin. And that's not necessarily putting a lot of new money into the private sector, you know, where a consumer can get a job and get a good paying job. So we're in a sticky situation.
I know so many people, it's funny, and just talking to a clerk at a store or a bartender at a restaurant, it is interesting. It's impressive to me how many people say, well, this is my second job, third job. I bumped into a woman the other day in the parking lot, and we were just chatting. And I says, what are you doing? She says, oh, I'm dropping something off. I said, oh, I didn't know you worked for that company. She said, this is one of my 4 jobs. But what does that say about employment, though? So the employment numbers are accurate, right?
Well, I think they're accurate, but it depends on how. When you dig down into the data, it's like what kinds of jobs are being created, and you know these are not the jobs that are coming out in the jobs reports nowadays. The jobs that are being created are not necessarily what we would consider living wage or career jobs. They're these side hustles and they're these part-time jobs that are getting filled, but they're being counted because you have a new employee on the payroll. And so I think you have to really take these job reports with a grain of salt because, as you were just mentioning, you know, you have people having 2, 3, even 4 jobs in this case. And they're having a hard time making ends meet, right? And most of these jobs do not come with great benefits either. So I think we really have to step back and number one, try and get inflation under control in other means other than just raising interest rates. There are means, and I know not everyone loves the idea of maybe increasing some of our energy sources, at least temporarily, so we can kind of ease the burden of energy costs on the U.S. consumer. Because really, I mean, we've seen oil prices just continually increase, and we're starting to see it at the gas pump. And that is all passed through to the consumer when they buy a product at the store because increased shipping costs. And, you know, if we could just increase maybe some of that supply, at least temporarily, to give us some reprieve and let's call it catch up. you know, that's one way of helping reduce some of these inflation costs as well. So it's not just the only tool in the toolbox that the Federal Reserve has.
Well, if inflation is causing people to pull back on their spending and people pull back on spending, doesn't that bring inflation down?
It will. It's a little bit more of a lagging indicator, though. And we may not start to see that until some of the, you know, May, June, July reports. And I think we will start to see that. I think we're going to see it in consumer spending for sure. And, you know, the price index is a little bit different than consumer spending. And So when we do start to see those numbers hit the tape, I think we are bound to start to see a little bit of relief in the market and maybe add some stability as well.
Jamie Dimon warns that inflation, wars, and Fed policy pose major threats ahead. I'm just reading a headline there from CNBC. I wonder if what's happening in Gaza or Ukraine are going to put pressure on the economy. Are we going to feel that in the United States?
Well, I think we will. I mean, it's all about, you know, we have a huge amount of government spending going on, right? And our debt just keeps going up, and our interest, our debt service is really almost unaffordable. This week, I heard we spend more on interest for our government obligations than we do defense spending,
yeah,
you know, for the year. And, you know, when you have that kind of debt service and you have the tax rolls that are coming in that, you know, if we're not getting and creating good paying jobs, the tax rolls and the tax receipts that are coming in just aren't going to keep up with that. And if we keep spending more money and creating more money to send to these, you know, to these countries, and I mean, believe me, that's a whole nother discussion, right? But I think that that's going to create even more debt, which is going to create more interest expense. And so it's a little bit of a snowball effect. And, you know, we were close to a balanced budget way back in the Clinton years. And then, you know, the credit crisis of 2008 and then, of course, COVID just created a huge amount of stimulus and amount of government spending that we just have not been able to get back under control. And so until we can get that a little bit under control, it's two-sided, right? It's getting an economy with good paying jobs. It's also controlling your spending. You know, you look at it as a household. If we were a household overspending every single month by so much and having to put more debt on credit cards and pay that interest payment, it's at some point it's unsustainable.
Oh, understood. And, understood.
You know,
if we were $30 trillion in debt at my house, I wouldn't sleep at night, but we kind of are.
I wouldn't either. I'd have a hard time with that. Yeah, we
and
are.
Mm-hmm. On that note, we've got to leave. Farron Dawes, the founder and CEO at Harrison Wallace Financial Group. Okay, Farron, good to talk to you today. Thanks for the insight.
You too.
Joining us now, Chef Sebastian White, the founder and executive director of the Evolved Network. They call it 10, and they just received a grant, and we want to first talk a little bit about what you guys do, Sebastian, and then tell us about the grant. Welcome to the show. You're on WGN.
Hi, John. Thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited to be on your show. Really appreciate the platform and the opportunity. The Evolve Network is a project that I put together and founded to honor my father and my aunt who passed away in the spring of 2020. So I kind of fused our passions in what I believe is a really powerful, unique way. And our concept is reimagining what therapy can look like through the farm-to-table process.
So therapy can look like. What do you mean by that?
Yeah. Well, I think in a lot of situations, particularly where therapy is going, it's very standardized and traditional in terms of like talk therapy, in terms of like diagnostics and fixing. And it uses a medical model that I think could be dangerous. And so I'm adjusting that and allowing whatever happens within a space to happen. And we're just using the farm to table process to create that connected space for kids where they can open up and discuss those things as they come or have experiential lessons through the tangible skills that they're learning.
So if I hear you right, it's a kind of therapy through making food?
Yes, essentially. So I think the kids are learning tangible skills as we're cooking together, right? But there are intangible conversations and things that are coming up through the process.
Yeah, yeah.
For example, a kid cutting an onion says, I don't like cutting onions because it makes me cry. Maybe there's more to why the kid has a problem with crying, right? Those type of conversations come up. I've had a lot of kids talk about traumas that they've had. It just comes out of nowhere into our space because it's connected, it's trusting, and they feel the value in what's happening. And it allows for them to feel like they can open up and be real and be true to themselves within our space. And it's
so
pretty powerful.
How is it that you are helping kids? Is it a brick and mortar location where they go to? Are you streaming this stuff online? How are you doing it?
Got it. So now a lot of people are actually reaching out to me, but I have been connected with either other nonprofit organizations that have facilities and or schools. I'm a part of people's school days in some places, and other places I have after school programming in their spaces. I am working on developing a space because I do want us to have a home base, but my focus right now is maintaining that our presence within school and in with our partnered organizations.
Tell me a little bit about your background as a chef.
Got it. So I am relatively new to the scene. I have no formal training. It's just something that I love to do. As a kid growing up, I love cooking. I like feeding myself. I was an athlete as well, so I was looking at other ways to eat healthy and support my my body through also having good food, but thinking about being thoughtful about it. My background is actually in psychotherapy, but when I transitioned to this, I knew that I needed to create a brand and a reputation around myself about the quality of my food, so people believed in the messaging beyond just this idea. I've been very fortunate in how the Chicago chef scene has embraced me. My mentor is Sarah Stegner. She is obviously distinguished and big-time chef in the city. Paul Kahan has also mentored me and has been a huge supporter of not just my work, but my growth within the food space as well. So these are two really strong names, and among others, that I've also collaborated with, and we've done some dinners to raise some money and some awareness to bring people along on our journey in terms of what we're trying to build here at the Evolve Network.
And the Evolve Network, just to be clear, is then this network, this outreach that you're spearheading to help kids who are dealing with some sort of trauma. Are you working in the Chicago Public Schools? Where are your kids coming from?
So I am in multiple Chicago Public Schools. I am also with a private school out in Austin. I do work at Build, Inc. in Austin as well. I've partnered with a lot of wonderful other organizations like the Gardeniers within their school spaces and with the relationships that they have.
Yeah.
So I've been pretty much all over the place. I am really trying to focus my attention on the south, southwest, and west sides of the city with those kids. That is where the majority of my programming takes place.
You know, I can imagine, though, I think a lot of us can relate to the fact that meaningful conversations happen in the kitchen. And sometimes it's when your head is down and you're thinking about food. Yeah, that's, you know, literally a nutrition for people. And I can imagine it's kind of a healing space where you're doing something, but you also can talk about something. And that just makes perfect sense to me. If you could, though, tell me about this grant then that's coming your way.
Got it. So Chicago Beyond partnered with the NBA Foundation. So after George Floyd was killed, the NBA players went to the NBA and suggested that they wanted them to do something. So the NBA Foundation was created, and they have found organizations within each city that has a team to look and search for organizations that are supporting the development of Black youth, particularly economically. And we were the first five chosen here in Chicago, by Chicago Beyond. And so they have granted us funds. It was really huge and significant for us. That was our first, like, really big grant that we've received. I'm happy that they saw the value in what we're doing, because I feel like to impact kids economically, you also have to impact their hearts, to give them hope, expand their perspective. And I think food does that. Food changes how you experience the world. I keep telling people, I think we are how we eat. And if I can expand the boxes that our kids put themselves in and open themselves up, I think it changes not in just in terms of what they eat, but how they live. So really, really trying to capture these really beautiful analogies that are all over the place if you look at the farm to table process.
If you want to find out more, Chef Sebastian White's on the line, the founder and executive director of The Evolved Network. Go to TheEvolvedNetwork.org. Really interesting. Good work, Chef. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
You bet. Here's more business news with Steve Grzanich.
Start your timer. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing Chicago's business news of the day. Online brokerage company TastyTrade is expanding its headquarters in Chicago. The company's new office space in Fulton Market covers 35,000 square feet and will include a broadcast studio for production of financial market content. The company's Tasty Live broadcasts, including more than 100 original shows, reach millions of people worldwide. TastyTrade has also announced a $600,000 donation to Greenwood Project, a local nonprofit organization that creates career pathways for Black and Latino students in the financial services industry. A Chicago startup that provides in-home medical spa treatments has raised $3.5 million in seed funding. Pinch is also recruiting nurse practitioners to provide medical spa treatments like fillers, chemical peels, and IV treatments. The company currently serves 250 zip codes, and other expansion plans are in the works. Pinch says it gives nurse practitioners more power over when and where they want to work, increasing their earnings potential. The service has thousands of clients following its soft launch last year. One of the founders was also involved in the Spot Hero parking app. I'm Steve Grzanich, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
We've got the business of food now, and Steve Alexander.
Yeah, thank you. It's a Mr. Fizz Friday, and gardening guru Jim Fizzell is going to be on with us to talk about something he calls straw potatoes. Right after I thank the Chevy Silverado and ChevyDriveChicago.com for sponsoring us today. There's never been a better time to put a Silverado in your toolbox. Okay, Mr. Fizz, it seems like if we're not complaining about how dry it is, we're complaining about how wet it is.
Yeah, it's been really wet. We've had a swamp in the backyard. My gosh, we couldn't do anything out there. So.
Yeah, well, that's no good, but I imagine it'll dry out sooner or later, and then we'll have plenty of work to do. But right now, you wanted to talk about straw potatoes?
Yeah, we have very heavy soil where we are, and growing potatoes underground is troublesome because the potatoes don't form very well. They don't become nice round potatoes. They become kind of oblong, knobby things. We can grow things called straw potatoes. That doesn't mean that they grow from straw. That means they grow under the straw. You work up the soil thoroughly to get it up to good condition, fertilize it as, but you don't dig trenches. You put the potato pieces out in rows. Incidentally, you do not want to try to take a potato that's from the supermarket and grow it because they use growth inhibitors on them to keep them from sprouting. And you cover them with 6 inches of straw. Now, these pieces will grow in the ground underneath the straw. You'll see the shoots begin to come up over the top of the straw, and you're going to have plants that are just like the straw wasn't there. The only difference is that the plants are not in the ground. If you want some potatoes, you pull the straw back, and there are potatoes there. Lo and behold, this is usually beginning about the longest day of summer, the end of June. You're going to have little potatoes. A cute thing to do, a fun thing to do, especially for kids, because they're going to be able to get out there without having to dig a hole to get the potato out and just pick a couple of potatoes, even if they're little salad potatoes, the little tiny ones that we like to use as a side dish.
Oh, I do like those little potatoes. Thank you, Mr. Fizz. Jim Fizzell, our gardening guru. On the food calendar, it's National Licorice Day, red please, and National Grilled Cheese Sandwich Day. Where's the tomato soup? I'm Steve Alexander. That's the business of food on 720 WGN.
On the Business Lunch, we talk about all kinds of businesses, and I think it's no great revelation that some people find that they're pretty good at doing something, but it doesn't mean you're good at running the business of doing that. And that's where our next guest comes in. Here is John Frank, the founder and CEO of Third Road Management. Hi, John. You're on the air. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thank you so much for having me.
I trust you appreciate that introduction, right? Some people say, oh, I can do this, but it doesn't mean you're good at running the business of doing that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, pretty much universally across the board, you know, what you see is someone that has a skill. They might be a great engineer or developed a great product or, you know, be skilled in a certain trade or maybe be a great salesperson, right? But that doesn't mean that they have, all the tools in the belt required to run a business effectively.
And so what do you do about that?
Yeah, so what we do is we plug in, we have two lines of service. One is accounting services, which are traditional, sort of closing the books, doing regular bookkeeping, creating regularly scheduled financial reports. But then the second side of our business is our fractional CFO work. And where that picks up is sort of where the accounting leads off. And really, now that the numbers are done, we're looking at the business holistically, strategically, financially, and operationally to tell us, you know, read the numbers and say, okay, what are these numbers telling us? But also look at the future and say, okay, how can we get to our preferred future, knowing what our current reality is, right? And then the other big piece about the way we think about the CFO role within an organization is, you know, it's really the hub in the wheel of how a business operates. And so I think traditionally people associate the CFO role with that of an accountant. And I think accounting is a really good tool in the belt. But I think to be a great CFO, you really have to be well aware of and understand all the disciplines within an organization, how they fit together and how they can work in cohesion with one another. Because I think ultimately every dollar that gets spent in an organization goes through that CFO's office. Mm-hmm. So, you know, deciding how to allocate those dollars and how to do it in the best way to make the business run most effectively with the minimal amount of risk and the highest upside is kind of what we're looking to accomplish.
Well, tell me a story about a client of yours, maybe a typical client, but just tell me how somebody came to you, what they were doing right or wrong, what you did for them.
Yeah, I mean, I'll take us through sort of our origin story. We were, you know, I was working on Wall Street, had quit that job and went to work in the nonprofit community. And as a byproduct of that, had some time that was available to me on Fridays. And I had a friend of the family reach out to me. It was, you know, mid Seven Fingers commercial printing business here in the city. The CFO had resigned. And when he called me, he's like, I could be there tomorrow morning. And I show up there and I said, well, what is it that you need to, you know, me to do? And he said, well, I need the compliance certificate complete for the bank. I need my books closed for, you know, month end. And, you know, our line of credit is really close to being maxed out. And I'm a little concerned about our leverage. And I said, okay, well, good news, bad news. The bad news is I'm not the guy that closes your books. I could probably do it, but there's probably somebody more capable than I can. But the good news is I think I can find a way to do this. And I think if you added up the cost of what his CFO had been costing him at that time, it was, you know, let's say it was, you know, by the time you add in payroll benefits and healthcare and things like that, let's say it was, you know, $170,000, $180,000. Well, I was able to find a group that did all of his tax work and all the month end close and all the bank's compliance certificates and things that he, you know, outwardly said that he needed for maybe $25,000.
Hmm.
And so he's like, okay, what else you got in the belt? And, you know, at the time, you know, not knowing, you know, at that time anything about commercial printing, I said, you know, okay, tell me how this works. And, you know, you go through all the iterations, you know, I looked at the sales team and said, okay, tell me how the sales team is incentivized. You know, a lot of people incentivize on sales versus gross margin, right? Is that the right way to look at it? I think every case is unique. You know, are you measuring success would be another thing. You know, do those salespeople know that, you know, what their goals are? And it was just blocking and tackling, you know, in specific case by asking curious questions, right? Another thing was, you know, I looked up on the wall and there was a, you know, the OSHA manual. And I was like, well, tell me about this OSHA manual. Like, and he's like, well, we did it 10 years ago and, you know, somebody probably keeps record of it somewhere. And I said, well, I know I met with your insurance broker. I go, I think I'm going to call him and see if they'd be willing to like pay for a mock OSHA inspection. And, you know, sure enough, that's exactly what they did. They came in and identified some areas that he could mitigate risk in the business. And, you know, it was a big win. So, I mean, on the whole, if you looked at it financially, you know, he had gone from maxed out on his line of credit to nothing outstanding on his line of credit. From, you know, leverage he was worried about to zero leverage, you know, which gave him a tremendous peace of mind. He was making more money than he ever made before. But, you know, I like to think about those risk factors too, when it comes to a business, because, you know, nobody wants to, you know, wake up one day and find out that, you know, the business that they built and loved and cherished, you know, because of some unfortunate event, right, caused a huge gap in their ability to move forward.
That's really interesting. I wish I had more time. John Frank is the founder and CEO at Third Road Management, and that's Third Road Management, MGT.com, Third Road Management. John, interesting. Well done. Thanks for your time today.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.